Welcome to a very special end of year episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast with me, Nate Langson, Olivia Solon.
Hello.
Liat Clark.
Hi there.
And Nicholas Tufnell.
Greetings.
And in our regular weekly programme, of course, we select and discuss five or six stories from the previous week's news pages on Wired.co.uk, from science and tech to almost any other topic under the Wired sun. And on this show, we're doing the same for kind of for the whole of 2013 in retrospect, and deciding what the five or six most important stories of the year were seemed a little bit too obvious, because 2013 has housed some pretty incredible moments, such as revelations about the NSA, Prism and GCHQ, Facebook's enormous and slightly flawed IPO. We had the discovery of the Higgs boson, of course, and more recently we've had a launch of an entire new generation of games consoles, plus obviously countless more enormous headlines well sewn into your collective consciousness. So instead, what we have each done is picked out our favorite story of the year. Big stories, important stories, articles that caused big discussion and debate, or pieces we were just kind of glad that we were able to cover in depth and detail. We're also going to look at some of the biggest trafficking stories on Wired.co.uk for the whole year and see if we can pick out some fun examples of unusual stories that maybe we didn't expect to be quite as successful or hard-hitting, maybe, as they were. So without further ado, let's explore the year in Wired.co.uk. First story picking in the Wired.co.uk duck pond hooking rod. I'm sort of thinking of a fairground Christmas fate, yes, type thing here, if you will, Liv.
As opposed to bird torture.
A little bit different, yes. Liv, what have you picked? What is your story of the year? Great band.
Oh, wow, that's a lot of pressure. My story is about a filmmaker who is being sued by the Techno Viking. Now, I think many of our listeners will be familiar with the Techno Viking. It was a character in a video that went viral in about 2007. And it features a street festival in Berlin where there's this topless hulk of a man leading a crowd of ravers in a dance towards a camera. And he looks like a kind of commander leading an army into battle. Now, it was shot by a filmmaker called Matthias Fritsch in Berlin, and it was shot way back in 2001. He was actually sitting on top of a moving truck which had the sound system on it, and so it made it look like this, a very kind of staged effect where all the dancers were sort of walking towards him when actually they were walking towards the music. But he made this film way back in 2001, put it on his own website before YouTube even launched, and called it Kneecam Number One. Not Techno Viking. He didn't even create that name. And then when YouTube launched, he put some of his videos on there. And then, you know, 6 years later, or 6 years after he first shot this video, it went viral. Someone ripped his video, renamed it the Techno Viking, and a meme was born. There have been since been like countless more videos created, people doing like dubstep versions, people doing kind of voiceovers, etc. And kind of Fritsch went along with this. Matthias went along with this. He sort of made some t-shirts to sell, but then he got sued by the Techno Viking. He got a letter from the lawyers saying that, you know, they were using his image without permission, which he kind of was, and he's been battling the Techno Viking ever since.
This was in 2009.
Yeah, so he's been battling since 2009, and the reason why we wrote about him this year was that Matthias was trying to make a documentary about the trials and tribulations of being sued by the Techno Viking. He won't name the Techno Viking because that would obviously draw attention to the man even more and probably rile him a little bit more.
Could he use the footage?
Well, that's the thing. So far, the agreement he's come to is that he's not allowed to use the image of this man in his videos. So if you look on Matthias's website and on his Indiegogo campaign that he was using to raise money for the film that he was trying to make, he's kind of cut out the silhouette of the man in all the footage. And then people have created their own cartoons, which he's using kind of cartoon caricatures of the guy, but not the actual footage. Unfortunately, the horse is slightly bolted. You know, this video is gone viral. Matthias no longer has control over who does what with it. It's on, you know, it's on every kind of meme site you can find.
And this was back in June that we reported on this. And this was one of the most popular stories on the website this year.
Mm. Yeah.
This feature that Liv wrote.
But unfortunately, it kind of didn't actually go... the story that I wrote in June wasn't that popular when I wrote it. It just got picked up in October on Reddit on Today I Learned, and it got a huge amount of traffic. Unfortunately, it was a bit late for the Indiegogo campaign that Matthias was running to raise money for the film. But even without that traffic, he managed to raise 2/3 of his target and has been shooting the film. I actually contacted him this week just to catch up with him to see how it's all going. And he said he's been filming in October and November, interviewing lawyers and scientists and fans. Kind of he's looking at the phenomenon of memes and copyright and what happens when someone, you know, finds themselves the subject of a meme.
Well, there are meme lawyers now, like people and meme promoters who you can contract.
Yeah.
Like Grumpy Cat, you know, they have PR people.
Yeah, well, I guess this was probably a bit early for that when this all happened. And his legal case is ongoing. Apparently, Techno Vikings lawyer wants more money. Not only does he want to be compensated for the advertising revenue that Matthias made and the T-shirt sales, but he wants, I think, 10,000 euros for the pain and suffering caused to this man.
Oh, really? Yeah, because I was wondering, it wasn't just a money thing. He didn't like the fact that he was being portrayed as Techno Viking.
Yeah, and finally, the lawyer for Techno Viking wants to ban even the black silhouette of the Techno Viking and the user-drawn comic versions that he shows on his website.
Is this a slight incarnation of the Streisand effect to a certain extent?
I think almost certainly.
In fact, maybe we should have charged for giving such massive amounts of publicity.
Yeah, well, I'm worried they're going to kind of come after us.
We're a target now.
Nah, editorial. It's fine. Review. No, it's a fascinating story. I love it. I mean, there's some great videos as well in Lisby. I remember when you first published this piece, I actually didn't remember the thing at all. My first learning about what this was and the whole history and what was happening with it was when Liv wrote the feature back in the summer. And it's amazing to think that it started basically in 2001 and was pre-YouTube.
Yeah.
And is still going around. I mean, in terms of longevity, that's got to be one of the longest sort of modern memes, if you like, because something like Keyboard Cat was filmed in the 80s, but didn't become popular until YouTube made it possible for videos like that to be easily shared and go viral.
Oh, but Keyboard Cat, he's highly litigious. He's been
Keyboard
at it.
Cat.
Yeah.
Well, they did a new one. They did a second one, actually, the guy, because the original Keyboard Cat was dead long before his video was famous on the internet.
Aww.
And the guy, I think he's a German chap, he got a new cat and dressed that one up as Keyboard Cat 2. And that's when I found out about it and wrote a feature about him, about how you go about basically trying to recapture your previous meme success. And that's on the website too. Maybe I should have picked that as my story of the year. I don't know. Well, you can read that one as well. Well, if you want to keep on top of what's going on with Techno Viking, I suppose Liv's feature from June or July is not the worst place to start if you search Techno Viking or one word.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure we'll be doing an update sometime in 2014. See how it goes with poor Matthias Fritsch.
Definitely. Well, as with all of these stories we're going to talk about today, find the show notes at wired.co.uk/podcast and find the Year in Review special, and you'll find links to this story and all other stories we're going to talk about next. Next story of the year comes courtesy of Liat, who, when I asked her to pick what is your favourite, most important, biggest, best, most loving story of the year, or most loved story of the year, you chose 4.
Yeah.
And then Liv and I had to pick.
That was a short list.
Which of those 4 was best?
Like
this one stood out. Liv and I both picked this one out of your 4 contenders. And this was headlined, Dutch design studio develops system to suck smog from the Beijing sky. I mean, that is a cracking headline.
I love these guys. These guys just write their own headlines. They write the headlines for us, basically. They make such cool designs.
Just to clarify,
cool write the headline. No, but it's this Dutch design studio called Studio Roosgaard. It's exactly what it says in the tin. They want to vacuum smog particles from the sky, scoop them up and turn them into saleable goods, which is pretty cool. I spoke to Dan Roosgaard, the guy behind the project, who is also responsible for the rechargeable glow-in-the-dark road markings that we also covered, I think, back in 2012. And that also kind of caused a bit of a stir. Everyone loved it. Trialled now.
I liked how he said he basically wants to hack the air.
Yeah,
I mean, this wasn't
really
that long ago for this story. I think this is about, what, October? October, September, yeah, something like that. Not too far back.
No, a couple of months back. He was like, I spoke to him and he said, you know, us Dutch, we love hacking nature with our windmills. And he doesn't talk like that. And now we want to hack the air. And they just have a really, really kind of great outlook in that they want to, you know, obviously make a commentary on the world, but using really cool techniques, which actually work. They have actually done a kind of small scale version of this piece, which was inspired when he was spending time in China, where obviously the smog is pretty horrific and just can, you know, really affects daily life.
Can you explain how it works?
Yes, I can, of course.
Go on.
So basically it works by creating an electrostatic field. And the way they're planning on doing this, they obviously didn't do this with they did like a 5 meter by 5 meter room. They're going to make it 50 by 50 meter park, bury copper coils under the park to create an electrostatic field in the air, which will drag the particles to Earth and leave a void in the sky. It sounds like ridiculous, and but when you can see a video of them doing it in a room, and it's pretty impressive that just suddenly this clear space appears. And and the idea is that, you know, kids can go to the park and actually have some fresh air and then watch the smog around them. He wants to turn the smog into like a giant kilometer long ring around the park, so that people can kind of, you know, mull on that disgustingness that's in the sky.
It's a little bit more marketable, I suppose, than air in a can like you buy in Whitby.
Yeah.
It's like, this air has been the air for quite some time, and it's touched many seagulls and pigeons and otters. Yeah. And then people pay about 10 quid a jar for that.
Well,
this is actual produce.
Yeah. And I assume it's going to be free to go into the park as well. It costs €1 million to make. So it's not hugely expensive. It takes 12 months to do. And they've got like the support of the mayor. Everyone's on board for this. But he was, for him, it is like a social statement. He was saying in China, you know, it's really odd. You go there and rather than attacking the problem and everyone being angry about it, the face masks people wear on a daily basis have become like fashion statements. You know, they decorate and design them. So it's, you know, he's trying to obviously say, come on, guys, let's get a bit more up in arms about this do something about it.
You see that a lot in Japan, in Tokyo,
yeah.
The face masks, but it's sort of the opposite way around, because when I first started noticing this in Japan, I thought, is it because everyone's afraid of germs? And it's not. It's basically an act of politeness to say, I'm sick and I'm doing my best not to give it to you. It's not about keeping germs out. It's about keeping your germs away from the fellow passengers.
Oh, that's interesting.
Whereas in this scenario, it's the exact opposite. It's, Christ, we're surrounded by smog.
Yeah.
Let's not breathe as much in as possible. I saw a really incredible photo yesterday. I think a journalist from one of the newspapers had tweeted about an airport that she'd gone through in Beijing that was just, it looked like it was full of smoke.
It looks like the apocalypse. It's actually really scary.
The amount of indoor smog now that is in some of these buildings. I mean, yeah. It really did look like something out of a very weird movie.
Indoor smog?
Indoors, yeah. It's penetrating the...
Oh, my
or is it
God.
No,
the smog from outside is now penetrating the buildings.
Oh, wow.
I don't know how common it is, but this photograph was of an airport. And I think it's in Beijing. It just looked like somebody had recently put out a fire in the airport and the smoke was just there billowing around.
The way they deal with it is kind of basically when it gets really bad, shut down factories, don't leave the house. Like earlier this year when it was really bad, my friend was living in China and sent me loads of pictures, and they just all worked from home. No one left their nice little apartment buildings because you couldn't see, you know, 2 feet in front of your face. It's so bad. But a lot of it's not dealt with long-term solutions. Basically,
well, someone's going to have to, and maybe Dutch artists will know. As ever, Liat's story is on wired.co.uk, is in our show notes at wired.co.uk/podcast, or you can search for Dutch smog
vacuum.
You will find it there too.
So now we come on to Nate. What was your story of the year?
Well, my story of the year will come as no surprise to anyone, has elements of Japan in it, as some of my favorite things are. Basically, you can pinpoint whether a story is going to really appeal to me to get stuck into. If it intersects with Japan technology and anything a bit weird, that's probably something I'd be very interested in. So earlier on in the summer, I went to Bristol, to the BBC in Bristol, to find out about this project that the BBC had been working on for about 4 years with Sega in Japan. And it was a project called Orbi. And essentially, it was a high-tech, experimental, purpose-built natural history theme park in Yokohama, which is in Japan, near Tokyo. And they had been working on this as a collaboration. That's BBC Worldwide and Sega. And it essentially is presenting re-edited BBC productions like Frozen Planet within environments that include things like a two-story high, 40-meter wide theatre screen that's larger than any IMAX. It dwarfs the IMAX, actually, when you're standing there. They have rooms that simulate Arctic conditions, so you can literally walk in and feel like you're a penguin standing in a Arctic blizzard as you're seeing the Frozen Planet scene in front of you of penguins standing in an Arctic blizzard. They've also got this crazy thing where about 24 people can stand in the center of a simulated wildebeest migration. And this thing is sitting on top of a very posh high-tech shopping mall in Yokohama, and it's open till about 11 o'clock at night, and it's crazy. And I followed the latter half of this progress over the course of about 2 months, eventually going over to Tokyo for the opening, for the launch, and to meet a lot of the Sega executives who've been involved in this, because a lot of the research for this was done on the BBC side here in London and in Bristol, and to really experience the result of this. It was fascinating.
It sounded so much fun. It seemed to involve, it was kind of the sight, the smells, even you had the vibrations of the wildebeest running. It was really kind of multi-sensory, I think would be the word they describe
it
as.
Was it quite unnerving?
It was.
Like, now, some of them wildebeest.
There were a couple. So one of the things that was really interesting is it is very much experimental. It's very, very weird. There's nothing.
Like some crying children come out and they're like, that's to be expected.
Well, there were certain things where they had to make decisions, strategic decisions, over how to present certain aspects of this production, because some of the Japanese ideas were a bit more intense than perhaps the British BBC guys had maybe thought it would ultimately be. And the result was just a lot of incredible collaboration to sort of work out what the best way of telling certain stories was. And it was fascinating. But there were a couple of these exhibits where I have to say, I don't want to say it freaked me out. I mean, I'm claustrophobic, for one thing. I'm not good in environments I can't get out of. I hate loud noises. I even wear earplugs when I go and see a film. And there was one particular room where the Arctic room, you're standing there, and the way they simulate the blizzard is you go into one room where it's at freezing point, and then you go into another room where it's about minus 20, something like that. And then they pummel you with air that comes out at something like 30 meters per second for about 15 seconds. It's about minus 30, 40 degrees, and it's definitely loud, howling, and it's in this white room that sort of looks like you're in some Arctic room, and it's hyper-chilled air being pummeled into you for 15 seconds, and I've never experienced anything like that. It was weird. It was a bit frightening for me because there was an emergency. I knew I was getting into something weird when there's an emergency button on the wall. Basically,
for
says,
when you panic.
If you're too frightened, hit it and it'll stop and you can get out.
Also, like, what if you're old or infirm? Do they but it was full of kids. Dress appropriately?
No. But this was one of the things.
Eyeballs freeze.
This was one of the things because I'd done so much of the reporting for this as they were developing it and on the technical side and with the producers at BBC and some of the local people in London and in Bristol. I needed to go over and experience this to find out what it was like and to make sure that some of this stuff, which to me sounded a bit over the top and a bit crazy, actually came out the way that the BBC intended it, because they had edited all the footage and come up with some of these concepts, and the Sega team had developed like the physical infrastructure and the technology to make this stuff happen in the way that they both intended. And this one was one that sort of freaked me out a little bit, but you know, those kids there, they were loving it. They're like penguins. And one example apparently was they would get groups of school kids who would go in and they get blasted by the wind, and then they go in again and they do it in a huddle together like the penguins were doing on the screen
to try
and see the difference it makes. So
that's
it really did have the desired effect, even though it made, you know, some older people like me stand there going, bloody hell, this is weird.
I'd love to know what the unadulterated Sega version would have been if the BBC wasn't there reining them in. Like,
it wasn't like that at all. It was just more in the ideation phases of these things. You know, everyone has to decide, like, you know, how do you make it more extreme? Do you make it less extreme? And they're talking about exporting this to various other markets and possibly even the UK down the line. But I wanted to follow up a little bit on this, and I spoke to some of the people involved to just get some top line sort of feedback on what's going on there. And it is doing well. And at the moment, Charlotte Jones, who was one of the women I was speaking to, who is in charge of part of this project, was testing to see whether footage shot in 6K. Could work on this, like, as a single framed shot on this 40 meter wide super, like, 180 degree screen, basically. So they're testing that at the moment.
If you want to find out more about Orbi, you can check out the show notes for the Year in Review podcast special, or you can just search for ORBI on wired.co.uk.
Next up, we're going to bring in Nicholas Tufnell, who's written some fab stuff over the last few months that he has been with us. And you chose this story, which is female squid feign having testes to spurn male advances.
Yeah.
Another brilliant wide headline, I have to say.
This is great. It's Liv's brilliant headline, actually. It's fantastic. And it combines my two favourite things, genitals and science. So... that's always good.
When
so
you hear the headline, are you like, of course, it just seems obvious now.
It was natural. Testes. Yeah. So the female common market squid can change its appearance to make it look as though it has testes. The squid has two stripes either side of a single central stripe. If she changes the central stripe from transparent to white, it signals to other cephalopods that she apparently owns a pair of testicles.
And so can stop advances from other
horny
squids.
Exactly. Daniel DeMartini, the doctoral student at UC Santa Barbara who discovered this feature, said that he's not sure why the squid does this exactly, but as you rightly guessed, supposes it might be to ward off sexual advances or to protect the survival of fertilized eggs. So obviously the female squid would have had some female fun somewhere with a male.
Female fun.
Some female fun with a male squid. And then she said, right, that's enough. You know, the eggs are now working there. Magic, and I don't want any more of you in me. So
I've read a few fish stories like this, of like female fish not wanting advances and trying to look like the male of the species.
Oh, really?
They cloak themselves to look like a male, but never going as far as testes.
Well, one of the other stories that we had that's been very popular, I mean, this was a very popular story, and this we published this one in September, but we've had a number of ones about genitals, in specifically in the insect world, and spiders who dislocate their penises to effectively plug the lady after the act is complete.
Keeps the skill.
Yeah, which is
means
when you
no
think
other
about
males can do
nature,
it.
It's pretty impressive some of the lengths they go to prevent pregnancy or to encourage.
They actually call it a pedipalp. That's their penis.
Really? Oh. The dislocated penis.
Pedipalp. I think that's what they call it in spiders.
Well, apparently the male penis in a human is shaped in a way that it's shaped to scoop out any sperm that was in the woman beforehand.
Is that true?
God.
That's what I've heard. That's why it's shaped in that sort of arrow. arrow. Right,
please
guys?
Stop showing us with your hands.
In related but non-testicle news, this was the first time that researchers observed switchable white cells based on reflectins, which are the proteins responsible for reflecting light as colour. So the discovery provides further evidence that transparent polymers can be used to produce nanostructures that control the behaviour of light. Now, by harnessing this phenomenon, new advanced materials with optical and electric applications could be developed, such as advanced camouflage. So what we're talking about here is squid-enhanced soldiers.
No wonder this story was so popular. No wonder you chose it as your pick of the year in review. I mean, it's so far, I mean, we've gone from female squid feigning having testes. We've done Orbi Project, BBC and Sega, slightly terrifying me in Japan. We've had ways to suck smog out of the sky and turn it into something useful. And of course, the Techno Viking. I mean, we're only four stories in. And this is why we decided to let everyone pick one story, because really the spread of some of the stuff we published this year is absolutely amazes me. Fascinates me.
That was I couldn't pick one.
It was a fantastic story, and it was written by Liv, and you can find it on wired.co.uk.
Well, next up, normally Well, I say normally. We haven't done a year in review podcast before, but we did want Katie to be here, but unfortunately Katie is off poorly today. So it's Liat's birthday, but we have no Katie. So it's like the world is trying to average everything out. But I did email her to ask her, what is your favourite story of the year? And she picked the story that Kadim wrote, who unfortunately is not with us anymore, although I think he's doing phenomenal.
He's live, though.
He's live, and he's...
interject.
He's doing another master's degree, I think. He's a smart man. But he wrote this story entitled, Mark Rober Left NASA to Make Awesome Wearable Tech Halloween Costumes.
Yeah.
And this story did incredibly well for us, and this is the one that Katie wanted to pick, and Liat is going to tell us about this story, which was published in the, I think, in this, about the summer sort of time.
Will you do Katie's accent?
No.
No.
Former NASA mechanical engineer, Mark Rober, left NASA after working with them for 9 years, among such projects as the Curiosity rover, which we all know and love, to create wearable tech Halloween costumes. And he recently has proven that this is quite the market. He sold his company Digital Duds to the British company that makes morph suits, and now works there developing new and terrifying ways to terrify people. It began in Halloween 2011 when he decided to go to a Halloween party with an iPad on his front and an iPad on his back, kind of partially concealed, and using FaceTime he could create an illusion where people could see through his body.
So the camera on the front was displayed on the camera on the back, and vice versa.
Yeah, huh?
Fab.
Yeah, I know. Who would have thunk it?
Haven't found a squid doing that yet.
No, that's why humans rule. So he put a video of this on YouTube, got 1.5 million hits in a day, and thought, this is like as intriguing as space to people. Maybe I should do it for a living. So we made an app, made some t-shirts, and launched a website. And he instructed people, you can use this app by basically cutting a hole in your t-shirt, a bit of DIY, duct taping your device to it, and playing the app so it makes the illustrations look alive. And I think it was like a beating heart that, you know, is just about to be ripped out of your chest, your bloody chest. So that was a success. It went live in October 2012, and they made $250,000 in revenue, I think it is, in 3 weeks with no marketing other than that YouTube video that went nuts. And it's been downloaded 250,000 times since then, or at least back in September, I think it was, maybe it was July when Kadim wrote this. So he is now dedicating his life to this. You know, he gave up his job. He has realised that I want to make people happy.
What I love about the interview that Kadim did was the fact that he was asking about, like, you know, why would you leave NASA? Most people would, like, you know, kill themselves to work at NASA, or perhaps not kill themselves, but kill someone to work at NASA. And he said something along the lines of, if you'd seen the number of high fives I got at the first party where I wore my DIY costume, you know, you would realise why I left NASA to do this.
Well, it reminds me a little bit of something that maybe Chris Hadfield would have done. I mean, he did incredibly well being the sort of world's first social media amaze man.
I think space
in orbit, singing songs in zero gravity and putting them on YouTube for the Earth. You know, I think when you see the amount of praise something that cool gets from a world, and actually gets people genuinely interested in science at the same time, I think is pretty cool.
And moustaches.
Did he have? Oh, he had a cracking moustache, didn't he, Chris Hadfield? Let's not usurp Mark Rober, who created this fab story. As ever, on wide.co.uk, if you search for Mark Rober, R-O-B-E-R, you'll find Kadim's piece.
But can I just say that if you weren't sold on it so far, that there is now a version where you're using your accelerometer, you can make an effect that looks like your intestines have been ripped out when someone slaps you on the back.
Thanks. Well, that is the wired.co.uk year in review, but I did a quick count in the time we've been recording this, and we have written in our office over 4,000 stories about these sorts of things since January, just this year. So wired.co.uk is the place you need to go to next year, let's just say that, for another 4,000 stories about things as diverse as squid and bioprinted hearts and people who leave NASA to go and create amazing Halloween costumes, and basically some weird stuff that's going on in Japan that I report on. So thank you very much for taking the time to listen over the last half hour or so, and have a happy break.
Bye.
And a lovely new year.
Yes.